the room, your mouth opens round as the rim of a tumbler limned with sugar. A drink that slams a howitzer. Blows a word with the dimensions of the room untethered, that sheds the ballast clamoring for our lives. We are taking a short leave. Now you can speak without fear of making things happen. I won't, but if I reached for the remote, they'd still be picking bodies off the coast, taking us through their network killings. A girl on that box stepped into a bush and explained she had the same build and looks as the victims. Or we could breeze to the window and see the same city out there if you're worried. We can be reached. Sleeve your reserve. Speak the code word. How can you have known it? We must be spies assigned here from somewhere. You smile the shape of it with your mouth, but it's not it you're after. Sounds like it, though. Sometimes you follow it through with the shape of the room slam. It all does this thing to me. Oh. So this is very exciting. This is my first time reading in Cork. I'm going to read some poems from the new collection. And some new poems as well. And I thought I'd start by reading the one poem I have, which is set in Cork. Which I wrote one summer when I came here looking for work, which I did not find. And this is called Silt Whisper. Silt Whisper. That summer, one-eyed jacks were wild. We learned new rules, left tea to brew. Smoke stilled air, leaves lay unturned. Unemployment was another high. I had been a storm in a polystyrene cup, seeking scald, steam, instance. But now we drew up lists, mapped out desire lines, skipped interviews to collect blooms, paused before flight. The only record of that time, the silt of prophecy, the memory of weight in our cupped hands. For a short while, we held the one breath. I could never set it down. So recently I've got quite interested in the idea of performative language, which is any language that makes things happen. And the very famous example is the wedding vow. So you have two people, and then they say something, and they become a unit. So it's sort of the most communicative public function of language. And in the poem, it's always in tension with the most private function of language, which is to give names to concepts so you can move them around in your head, so you can think. And in this next poem, it's the latter function that I was using, really. I was thinking about a relationship, which was a friendship, but a friendship with certain complications. And so the only way to think about it was to give it a name. So the name I gave it was Umbrella. This is the Umbrella. Look at this couple scooting round the grass. You can see that he has spoken the rain so they can hold the umbrella together. It's not an umbrella. It's a silken manifestation of something they've talked over and over. That's why they parade it before a guided tourist, the man with two croissants, the official lovers. In their slipstream, sunshine floats across blind brick faces, puddles, where I stop to cross the road. It's a creature they're minding, a parallel universe. Later, they'll shelve its sinuous objections and carry the umbrella upstairs to its aquarium. Kiss it. Wish it good night. Godspeed. Slána Waala. I love how it moves, so queerly eely through that briny other world in which we can only splash. And there's a sense in which words have been making things happen a lot in the world recently, not just in the sense of Twitter and Facebook letting us know what's going on, but things like people deciding to call something an uprising or a rebellion or a revolution, or a Western leader deciding to say, well, I'll choose this side over the other. But with poems, there's always that anxiety that instead of making things happen, you'll mesmerize the reader, you'll hypnotize them and keep them from doing anything at all. So I thought that a poem maybe needs to aspire to be like a religious icon, which is something that represents God, but also through its lack of perspective and through its stylized nature, insists that God can't be represented. So anyway, this next poem is called Icon. Icon. The bibelot I brought you from Cluj-Napoca looms over our flat in South Bend, Indiana, its feathered wings cocked like an antenna. Being an icon, that bird or holy ghost will always deflect you back to the thing itself, the res, the broad black tracks over which she hovers. Pointing one quavered wing towards Detroit, Chicago, Boston, or New York, along the Amtrak or the South Shoreline, she may supervise the hot-hatted Amish or tend to our own Thoreauvian insistence on honest suffering's own sake in transit, you and me. There are some crude flurries of snow ranged around her in bristled threes. The turn prints in snow of Glork's fleeing lines in flight, or the three that exists outside signs, in the still point amidst them, making them shiver, the steam whistle, the train tracks that shudder like a mirror in its frame when a train passes, shuddering a house near the railway with a framed mirror in it. Snow is always general in Ireland now. It is always also ashes. It is the backdrop for roses. And the same Romanian made the frame that encloses the whole of the icon, I mean, as if taking full responsibility for the putting of this thing into the world. It seems we also think, you and me, that a life, two lives, lived deliberately, carefully, might evade somehow the arbitrary, the unintended pun, the rhyme that leads a line astray. Three lives, maybe. What do we court when we speak of pregnancy? To what presiding gimmick could we pray for what parents seek? A future, some struggling, some ease. Would a child fear the creature was inclined to leave the picture, the way it keels its sheepish fleece? We might have to answer that we were gazing on the icon when our earth was blazing, that the very care we took was a displacement from the res, that the tchotchke I brought you on the train from Cluj-Napoca was loaded all along and cocked. One person who seems very confident that language can make things happen is Terry Eagleton, the critic. Because he once wrote that, this is him, the inherent unfinishedness and unpredictability of language, the fact that I can never deduce from any two of your words what the third one is going to be, is a token of human freedom, and thus, in a broad sense, political. And I wasn't sure I entirely bought that system, so I wrote a poem about socks. So I'll read that now, and I'll follow it with a poem about shoes, which is dedicated to the man who, when faced with George W. Bush, gave up on words and started throwing things. This is socks. I wear my socks odd. Queer bags, a couple of feet from my knees. I've heard that's how the first dyke snagged the fair sex. Maybe some night I'll catch a feel. Be honest, for that I wear my socks spotted, freckled with eyes, crossed all my T's as a young thing. I wear my socks beneath my boots, where they can't be seen. On very cold days, I wear my socks twice, and over my tights, but always odd. I believe that's right. That way you can't tell what colour my knickers will be. Shoes, from Muntazir al-Zaidi. Duck shoes. I saw them in a catalogue. Not ugly waterproof kicks or flippers for me to flop about the deck on wet days or wear to the pond in the park. Not duck shoes, nor shoes for a pet we might keep in a kennel. It was late last night, the duck was speaking of you. But mallard heels in black, a duo of duckling heads perched at the toes, leather upper, insole, sole. Designer Chi Mahara, decidedly retro, with a snap closure strap looped round the ankle, €300 a pair, not each, duck shoes, for me. Come on, just think of all the shoeless years. Those cork stones that rubbed a woman's soul to heck, the women still barefooting it across Africa in search of a well, and the years that were all too much about shoes. Bound lotus feet, Marie Antoinette, Imelda Marcos. Think of the spectacle. The bird-bodied celebrity chicks who had all Ireland enthralled with their black nicks. And the nine-year-old girl who stepped with both of her feet onto a landmine last week. But not us. And so, when we lay down in our double bed last night, it was duck shoes I didn't wear. To tramp all over your sleek white back, trace with a toe the seam of your cock, raise my two legs like arms raised to cheer over both of our grinning heads again, my dear. I suppose the other magic and danger of language is that the things you say and write change you. And it's something that troubles any illusion we might have of possessing sort of a constant identity from birth. So I'm a big fan of the transsexual character Agrado from Almodovar's film All About My Mother. And there's a fantastic scene in the film where she stands up and she tells the story of her life and how she became an authentic woman. And she proceeds to tell the cost of each of her body parts. So for example, her breasts, which she bought in Paris, are very authentic and very expensive. And she ends with the line, "It costs a lot to be authentic. But one can't be stingy with these things, because you are more authentic the more you resemble what you have dreamed of being." And I'm always so blown away by the last part of that, that I tend to forget about the first part, which is about the cost. This is Catacombs. Catacombs. Dressed to slay, breathing smoke like liberty. Perhaps you thought you could make that city yours, as long as you were there. We're surprised to find it riddled with unmanageable tunnels, where death demanded of you something pricey and uncertain. Perhaps you thought if you did not pay the entrance fee, but wormed in of your own accord by night, you could not be accused of tourism, would not be a citizen, could avoid the empty gaze of skulls, leave without guilt if you chose. Later, perhaps, when you tired of playing femme fatale with a murky native of that place, you thought, since you had gazed the other way, you could peel off those stockings and not be left with criss-crossed lines of red, prison fences netting in your pale, clean-shaven legs. I like when I do a reading to always read one poem by someone else. I think it's polite. So I want to read you a poem by Don Patterson, who is a Scottish poet. And this is called The Lie, and it's another poem about words being manifested. The Lie. As was my custom, I'd risen a full hour before the house had woken to make sure that everything was in order with the lie, his drip changed and his shackles all secure. I was by then so practiced in this chore, I'd counted maybe 13 years or more since last I felt the urge to meet his eye. Such, I like to think, was our rapport. I was at full stretch to test some ligature when I must have caught a ragged thread and tore his gag away. Though, as he made no cry, I kept on with my checking as before. "Why do you call me the lie?" he said. I swore. It was a child's voice. I looked up from the floor. The dark had turned his eyes to milk and sky, and his arms and legs were all one scarlet sore. He was a boy of maybe 3 or 4. His straps and chains were all the things he wore. Knowing I could make him no reply, I took the gag before he could say more and put it back as tight as it would tie and locked the door and locked the door and locked the door. Of course, it's what we read that really makes us who we are, which is why it's so difficult to regret the demise of the news of the world. This is a poem called Le Roué Won't Rail on the Champ, or excuse my French, which the title is a line from Bertolucci's movie The Dreamers, which is it's set in Paris in 1968 against the student riots. And the line, the La Rue, it literally means the street has entered the room, the bedroom. La rue est rentrée dans la chambre. Last night, when you clamped your hand over my sex, I thought for a moment there was blood on your hand. I had seen hands performing bloody acts on cable that day that looked not unlike yours, and thought you meant your hand to silence me. When you arrested my skin inch by inch with your mouth, I froze for a moment. You'd taste sweat on my skin. I had read accusations of inaction in the papers that day that all but spelled out my name and put myself a crime against humanity. If we faced each other then and pulled each other to each other, was there too much between our skins for us to have come? That day, we had watched bodies degraded in mixed media, glorious technicolor, all tongues and none. And now I do not know if I am free. Okay, I want to read 2 poems from the pub, since we're in the pub, and since the pub is a place of talk. The first one's a new one, it's called Shift. And the second one is dedicated to Lady Gaga, and it's called Telephone. And it's got a text message in it that I received while I was in the States, where I live at the moment. And someone had forgotten that I don't live in Dublin anymore, and they invited me to the pub, which was truly a bittersweet moment. Shift. They shipped Donegal workers into Dundrum in 2001. I worked in the Dundrum house all summer, lumping sods of peaty skirt from there to here. Those lads ordered with a nod or a lifted star of dark-skinned feelers, not a nay, not an I. They must talk among themselves, they must, a Cantonese colleague of mine hissed as we swiped the ashtrays to wipe. We vied between us to be the first to kiss one of those black northern men. I got closest when, once, a man stood and took a too heavy tray from my arms and moved ahead of me to the bar. He leaned in to empty his hod to the barman, turned and let drop his chin to raise a remark. What emerged then was a bubble as large as a brick, slick with aurora borealis, viscous and globular, spinning slowly forth over the tables of drinkers, the Norners in their knighted corner, the blinking cigarette machines, the locals blinking at that unidentifiable word. This is Telephone for Lady Gaga. A cinema under the dome, cheap matinee seats, and we have the whole show to ourselves, past the cookie dough. The thriller is set on an island, in a storm of course, so that the ferry is cancelled. And in the 40s, not just for the Cold War, psychotropic drugs, returning trauma of an aestheticized Holocaust, but because now our hero, on the run in a world shrunk so small when Hitler in it means mad days for all, could phone a friend and squeal, "Just get me out of here!" A little machine, which makes us able to say anything. It drops into my lap, out of the ether. A lightning bug crash-landed, its glow chirp and stutter. Lapsed on the couch, moon-faced by television, it insists on me still, its peel, lights, and vibration. "Pub?" the message ticks. Quick as that, I'm in Dublin. I'm stung, wrapped up, stepped out, lit. I'm light-stepping through the darkened park. I'm careening down the hill to the village in the dark, ordering, making the transaction, looking for the place to sit, and raising a glass to yourself for taking me out of myself. What's given by the blast is deep rain, an orgy of worms. Trees shake their manes, each branch a business of sexy division. Each bud has a drop for Ariel I want you to touch, spring and all that. We must have kissed 100 times in rain like this. I fell flat on my back in a field. We waltzed about the fountain in that Barcelona square, fought like cats and dogs and made up. Or when I dropped the bottle we were keeping and it crashed a gloria of crimson rivulets. You took me home all the same. All the same, the blasting veteran on our bus home wheels his unbusy stump. It never buds purple moles, explodes wild carrot. It stays the same. That's why in your arms I sing the man with a data drive embedded where his finger was. A virtual place where anyone can wield 6 lobster claws. Max the robot cat, the device you hold aloft when you don't know what's playing on the jukebox. Even our ultimate uploading to the internet. And the world-altering pill I take so that we make nothing with our love. All these years, only my crazy new hairdo, wet and wild against a field of white pillow, and the maddening blip of your phone, a little machine demanding to be plugged in again. Say you barricaded the place, sealed the exits. Say the plot was watertight. All the top bad brass are in your theatre, you projecting their doom. Your accomplice, an altar server, holds his taper to the stock, lighting the fuse. Bad guy flambe, let there be light, and it is good. Still, the call would come a year later or two. In your kitchen, the man you're with, chopping meats, would hand you the phone. It's for you. That's that. The lake monster's voice deadpans, crackling, rises to the shriek bark, the little moustache hopping, the knife slice, the in one ear and out the other, the audience gasping. Don't answer it. Don't answer it, I want to say, when the phone rings. I want to speak with your recorded voice for a predetermined number of your minutes. So last summer I went to Doolin, where they've recently opened a cave with an enormous stalactite in it. This really huge, incredibly beautiful stalactite. And it was really weird to think of that thing being in the dark all these years without anyone to see it. And it reminded me of Charles Bernstein's very strange argument that it doesn't matter if anyone reads poetry, because poetry is like a wilderness. Even if you never visit it, you're happy that it's there. So, I mean, Bernstein's obviously, he's partly making an apology for obscure poetry, which has that sphinx-like gaze, which some people find very attractive, but some people find extremely repulsive. And the same is true of the stalactite in Doolin. Not everyone finds it beautiful. In fact, the locals have nicknamed it the wet dishcloth. This poem's called Alphabet Noodles, and in part it's about that kind of encounter with ambivalent strangeness. Alphabet Noodles. I rented a trainee doctor with that Ranelagh flat. In either language, his words floated, dingbats. Each fridge memo, prescription, autograph lease, a private monogram. Face close as a cat, he'd lean in to lap at his bowl, small-toned, soapstone or bone-toned. No whiskers, though. He must, of course, have come here through another world and never mentioned it. Talked of patients instead, cases, the work-riddled surgeon from an American TV soap. Awake alone, late at night, against the wall, I listened in to his word-thickety bulletin, a war-timing missive scrawled two ways to save page, degapped to spare phone bill, or scrambled by my interference to a time-zoned distance. It's not that I didn't like him, you know. Still, that evening he pushed me the dish, sticks, purred, try it, picture my puss. The gruel glossy with wingdings, space invaders, tramp stamps, culled squiggly from the grimoire and slow simmered. A surface sonogram in terabine, where are my edges? The bottle of wine, the one sure thing between us, I lobbed it down, shared my purpley stained teeth with him, burbled. Since I'm kind of on the road, I'm off to London after Cork. I'm going to end with two travelling poems. A shorter one and a slightly longer one. The first one's got another French title, which I can't pronounce, called Je me souviens. It means I remember, and it's what you see on the registration plates on cars in Quebec. So, je me souviens. I recorded it all. The vast welkin, beaver tails, unicyclists, each quirked graffito, non-extinct elk, francophone, wobbling fleck of poutine like jello. We were circling 30, sailed a rented vehicle stacked with hair straighteners, antiperspirants, coconut M&Ms and lip balm. We all had passable boyfriends. Adrift among accidents of translation, the natives hardly noticed, let alone sanctioned or not sanctioned, our presence. But sure, we'd invaded. Without a harped ensign, we'd taken the place. It wasn't the first time, but this time we'd hold fast, being three Dundrum women at the peak of our powers, Carolyn Cummins, Alva Darcy, Isabel O'Connor. And then I got to compose the letter to the CEO of the World Empire. Give in to our demands for Ulster if you want Canada back in one piece. Okay, thank you for listening. This is the last poem. This is called Molly Bawn. And thank you to Paul for inviting me here. Molly Bawn. Two men slipped down a hole and found it. Massive, off-white, flirtatious, manifest. A blasted albatross or a wedding dress that had been dragged through dueling and hanged. It was there all along without us. You should have seen it, and in the cafe, the massive pavlova. I saw my sister write in the guest book that the great stalactite was a note in God's notebook. It had no designs on a mate. The second man's wife saw it a half century later. All that time it had grown like a growth inside her. When she saw it, she wept, for it seemed not to have aged. Her hair was white lichen by then, a fretwork of veins, hands a burn of lines, cunt a cave. Age accumulating uselessly, as calcium carbonate. One assumes she loved the man, The story does not relate. They've dubbed it the wet dishcloth in Doolin, but you would have seen poor Molly Baum, for they crooned her praises at the wake. Tramping to her lover's flat, snared in a downfall, she'd wound herself up in a sheet from the line, and he plugged her, taking her for a downy fowl. Truth be told, I was relieved, for it wasn't the cub she was marrying she was on the road to meet. Before Doolin, I had been in Connemara. Dead there was a good woman you had loved well, but I could hardly know. So I left you there to grieve. I came away. Wedding sometimes seems a loveless woman feigning love, who folds herself in between us. Bony arse, long hair, impossibly long limbs. Oh love, we intone, passing between our two hands stones, echoes, precious metals. Who lifts the frills of your flippy skirt to expose the slow-growing bony folds of a world, flirtatious, manifold, we cannot control. Let us alone. When the guide turns off his torch, it's still there. What's left unclear is whether that's my ghost, or its ghost, or your ghost, or hers, I suppose. Thank you.